"Do me the favor, Carmot, scholar of the bookhouse," said Joseph, "of not talking about matters you do not understand. It is frightful when a difficult and delicate matter gets to the ears of the masses, though it is something much too ticklish for them to grasp. They all lick their lips and talk the greatest tripe about it. Really, it is intolerable how they go on, and worse for the subject matter than even for the persons involved. It is naive of you, and not very refined, and does no credit to your renowned Egyptian culture, to have you talk like this to me. Not because I was yesterday your overseer and you bowed down before me, for I am laying that aside, but after all, you are to realize that I must know more and better about the affair between the mistress and me than you, who can only see it from the outside and hear only gossip about it. So why should you question me about it? Furthermore, it is absurd for you to contrast the barbarous cravings of my flesh with the standard of Egypt, when, after all, these latter have no very good reputation themselves all over the world. And when you talk about assaulting and leaping, and think no shame to apply such a word to me, you must be confusing me with that famous ram we are on our way to whom the daughters of Egypt yield themselves when he has his feast. And these are your fine cultural standards, forsooth. Let me tell you, it may come to pass that people will speak of me as one who preserved his chastity among people whose lust was like the lust of the stallion and the ass. Some day that may happen. Some day the virgins of the world may mourn for me before they wed, bringing me their maiden tresses, and singing a melancholy ditty in which they lament my youth, and recount the tale of one who withstood the hot solicitations of a female, and so doing, lost his life and his repute. As I lie here and ponder, I can well imagine such a tradition growing out of my story. Consider, then, how petty your comments must seem to me. And why, while rejoicing in my misfortunes, are you so surprised at them? I was Petipre's bought slave. Now, by his decree, I am become Pharaoh's. So, after all, I am more than I was. I have added to my stature. Why are you so simple as to laugh at that? Very well, let us agree that for the moment my fortunes are on the decline. But is it a decline without honor and solemnity? Does not this ox-boat seem to you like Usir's bark, when it moves down to light the great sheepfold below and greet the dwellers in the cave on his nightly ride? To me, let me tell you, it is strikingly like that. If you think I am parting from the land of the living, you may be right. But who shall say that my nose shall not smell the herb of life, and that I shall not rise the morrow morn over the rim of the world, even as a bridegroom goes forth out of his chamber, and his radiance blindeth the eyes of the dull of sight? Ah, ex-steward, I see you remain the same in all your misery. But the trouble is that nobody can tell what being the same really means. It is like the colored balls which jugglers send flying out of their hands and catch again, and you cannot see them as separate balls because they make a bright bow in the air. Where you get your cheek, no matter what happens to you, the gods only know, the ones you have dealings with, for god-fearing folk must get goose-flesh and pimples to hear you. You cannot get out of it by that rubbish about brides who dedicate their hair to your memory. That could happen only to a god. Or you're comparing this boat, which is, after all, the vehicle of your shame, with Usir's evening bark. Would the hidden one that you only compared the two? But you weave in the word strikingly. You say this boat is strikingly like that bark, and you know how to convince a simple soul that it is really the very bark after all, and that you may really be Ray, when he is called Aton, and changes into the bark of the night. And that gives one goose flesh. But one gets it not only from laughing and shivering, but also, and even more, from being angry, let me tell you, from disgust and bitterness like gall at your presumption, at the way you make bold to mirror yourself in the highest and identify yourself with him, so that you talk as if you were the same, and go on making an arch of balls so that I blink my eyes in exasperation. Of course, it is open to anyone to say such things and to behave like that, but a decent person would not do it. He would be humble and pray, I sat down here to talk with you, partly because I was sorry for you, and partly because I was bored. But when you give me to understand that you are Atum Re and Usir the Great in his bark, at one and the same time, then I must leave you to yourself, for my gorge rises at your blasphemies. Take it as you must, Kamat of the bookhouse and the buffet. I did not ask you to sit down with me, for I like quite as well to be alone, maybe even a bit better, and I can amuse myself without you, as you can see for yourself. If you knew how to entertain yourself as I do, you would not have come. But on the other hand, you would not look askance at the diversions I allow myself, and you do not allow me. You make out that you do this out of pity, but actually it is nothing but ill-will, and the pity is a sort of fig-leaf your ill-will puts on, if you will pardon the far-fetched comparison. A human being entertains himself. He does not pass his life like the dumb brutes. That is the whole point. That, and how far he goes in his diversions. You were not quite right to say that anybody might act the same as I. Not everybody might. Not because decency forbids, but because he lacks any harmony with higher things. He has just been denied any affinity with them. It is not given him to pluck flowers of speech from the fields of heaven, if you will pardon me another figure. He sees in the highest something quite different from what he sees in himself, in which, of course, he is perfectly right, and has no idea of serving him except with hymn tunes, which are tiresome. If he hears anyone else praise him in more intimate terms, he is green with envy, and stands before the image of the highest, and weeps crocodile's tears, and implores him to forgive the blasphemy. That is a really silly pose, Kamat of the buffet. You should not be guilty of it. Give me my midday meal, for it is time, and I am hungry. That I must, I suppose, if the time is here, answered the scribe. I cannot let you starve. I have to deliver you alive to Zawi Ray. Joseph could not feed himself with his elbows bound behind him, so Kamat had perforce to do it for him, there being no other way. Squatting beside Joseph, he had to put the bread in his mouth, and then the beaker of beer to his lips. Joseph commented upon it at every meal. "Yes, you squat here, long-legged Kamat, and feed me," said he. "It is kind of you, too, even though you feel ashamed, and show that you do not like it. I drink this to your health. At the same time, I cannot help thinking how you have come down in the world, that you have to feed me and give me drink. Certainly you never had to when I was your overseer and you bowed before me. You have to serve me as never before, as though I were become more and you less. It is the old question. Who is greater and more important, the watcher or the watched? But of course it is the latter. For is not even a king guarded by his servants? And is it not said of the just man, he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways? And so after a few days, Kamat said to Joseph, Let me tell you, I am fed up with feeding you and having you open your beak like a young daw in the nest, and when you open it, words come out that disgust me even more. I'm going to untie your bonds so that you are not so helpless, and I need not be your slave and angel. That is not a scribe's job. When we come near your destination, I will tie you up again and deliver you in bonds to the governor there, my Sakme, a captain of troops. That is only proper. But you must swear to me not to tell that official that you were free in the meantime, or that I have been lax in my duty, otherwise I shall be blamed. On the contrary, I will tell him you were a cruel warder and chastised me with scorpions every day. Nonsense! That is going much too far the other way. You never do anything but make fun of people. Of course, I don't know what is in the sealed letter I carry on my person, and I'm not sure what they mean to do with you. That is the worst of it. No one ever does know what to do with you. But you are to tell the governor of the prison that I treated you with tolerable severity and with firmness tempered with humanity. So will I do, said Joseph, and got his elbows free until they were far down into the land of Uto the serpent and the seven-branched river in the district of Jadet and near to Zawi Re, the island fortress. Then Kamat tied him up again. The governor of the prison. Joseph's place of penance and second pit, which he reached after almost 17 days' journey, and where, by his own transcendental reckoning, he was to spend 3 years before his head should be once more lifted up, was a group of gloomy buildings, irregular in shape, and covering almost the whole of the island that rose from the Mendesian arm of the Nile. It was a collection of cubical barracks, stables, storehouses, and casemates, grouped around courts and passages, surmounted at one end by a Migdol tower, the residence of the governor over the prison and the prisoners, and commandant of the garrison, Mai Sakme, a scribe of the victorious army. In the middle of the whole rose the pylon of a Wepwawet temple, whose standard was the sole relief to the eye in all that baldness. The whole was enclosed by a ring wall, some 20 ells high, of unbaked bricks, with projecting bastions and platforms jutting out in the round. The landing bridge and the fortified and guarded gate lay somewhere at the side. Kamat stood on the bow of the oxboat and waved his letter at the guards from afar. As they came under the gate, he shouted that he was bringing a prisoner whom he must himself in person hand over to the troop captain and head of the prison. Mercenaries, called Ne'eren, a military term adapted from the Semitic, lance-bearers with heart-shaped leather leaves on their aprons and shields on their backs, opened to the conveyance and let it through. To Joseph it seemed as though he were back in the times when he and the Ishmaelites were admitted through the gates of the fortress of Thel. Then he had been a boy, abashed before the marvels and abominations he saw in Egypt. Now he knew them all, the marvels and the abominations. He was Egypt, hide and hair, apart from the reservations he confined to his private thoughts respecting the follies of the land whither he had been snatched, and he had got a good bit beyond his youth and was well into manhood. But now here he was, led on a rope like Hapi, the living representation of Ptah in the court of his temple at Menphe, a captive in Egypt just like that sacred bull. Two of Petipre's people held the ends of his bonds and drove him in front of them. Behind them, Kamat addressed himself beneath the gate to an under-officer with a staff, who had probably given the order for admission, and was referred to a higher official coming across the court armed with a cudgel. This man took the letter, saying that he would take it to the captain, and told him to wait. So they waited, under the curious gaze of the soldiery, in a little quadrangle, in the sparse shade of 2 or 3 spindling palm trees tufted with green at the top, their round, reddish fruits lying about on their roots. The son of Jacob mused. He was recalling what Petipre had said about the governor of the prison into whose hand he was being given, that he was a man with whom one did not jest. Joseph's concern and suspense as he waited are easy to understand. At the same time, he reflected that the titular captain probably did not know the man personally at all, and had simply guessed that a man in charge over a prison was bound to be forbidding, a probable but not an inevitable conclusion. Joseph consoled himself with the thought that at least this was a human being with whom he would have to deal, and in Joseph's eyes that meant that he was somehow or other to be got on terms with. In God's name, however much he might be a born prison keeper, yet by this means or that, from one angle if not from another, he could be jested with. Besides, Joseph knew his children of Egypt, the denizens of this land who, against a background of death-like rigidity and a religion of the tomb, were blithe and inoffensive children at heart, and easy to live with. Then the letter which the governor was now reading, where Potiphar told him about the man he was casting out, so that the governor could get an idea of his affair. Joseph was confident that the description would not turn out to be too dreadful, that it would not be calculated to evoke the man's grimmest qualities. His real confidence, however, was more of a generalization. It proceeded, as it is wont to do with children of the blessing, not from himself outwards, but inwards upon himself and the happy mysteries of his own nature. Certainly he had got beyond the childish stage of blind confidence, where he had believed that everybody must love him more than they did themselves. What he continued to believe was that it was given him to constrain the world and the men in it to turn him their best and brightest side. And this, we can see, was confidence rather in himself than in the world. In any case, the two, his ego and the world, in his view, belonged together. They were, in a way, one, so that the world was not simply the world by and in itself, but quite definitely his world, and by virtue of the fact, susceptible of being molded into a good and friendly one. Circumstances were powerful, but what Joseph believed in was their plasticity. He felt sure of the preponderant influence of the individual destiny upon the general force of circumstances. When, like Gilgamesh, he called himself a glad, sorry man, it was in the sense that he knew the happy side of his nature was capable of much suffering, but on the other hand, did not believe in suffering. Bad and black enough it was that it had proved too dense for his own light, or the light of God in him, to penetrate. Such was the nature of Joseph's confidence. Generally speaking, it was trust in God, and with it he armed himself to look my Sakme, his taskmaster, in the face. In no long time he was set before him, for they were led through a low-covered passage to the foot of the citadel, to a barred door manned by other guards in helmets with bosses on them. The grating presently opened, and the troop captain came out. He was in the company of the high priest of Wepwawet, a lean, ball-pated man with whom he had been engaged in a game of draughts. The governor was a man of some 40 years, a stocky figure in a cuirass, which he had probably put on for the occasion, with little metal pictures of lions fastened on it like scales. He wore a brown wig, had round brown eyes under very heavy black brows, and a small mouth. His tanned and burnt face was darkened by a fresh growth of beard, and his forearms were hairy. His whole expression was oddly unruffled, even sleepy. Yet it was shrewd, too, this expression, and the captain's speech was calm to the point of monotony as he came out from under the gate in conversation with the prophet of the warlike deity. They were obviously still discussing the moves in the game, upon which the newcomers had had to wait. In his hand, the captain held the unsealed roll of the fan-bearer's letter. He stood where he was, reopened, and reread it. And when he lifted his face, Joseph had a feeling that this was more than just a man's face. It was the very presentment of forbidding circumstance with the light of God striking through. The very face which life shows to the glad, sorry man. The black brows were threateningly drawn, yet a smile played about his small mouth. Now he banished smile and threat together out of his face.